Have you ever experienced shin splints? If so, you're going to want to listen to this episode of the Conkcast. Friday. My name is Connor Collins. I'm a registered massage therapist and sports injury therapist. And welcome to the Conkcast, a podcast where we discuss all things health, wellness, and injuries in an attempt to better understand the human body. This is episode number 66. We're moving right along through this year's season, still producing one episode a week, which has been really, really great. And I appreciate all the positive feedback that the listeners have given me. For today's episode, I want to talk about a really, really common injury, particularly in athletics and especially in runners, and that is the injury of shin splints, which, as I said, very, very common. Many people complain about pain in the shin, and today we're going to try and unpack that a little bit more and allow you to understand what might be going on when you're feeling pain in the shin, and if there are areas of the shin that might lead you to think that you might have one thing versus another. And I think one of the most important things before we get into the topic of shin splints is we have to understand that not all shin pain is shin splints. And that's one of the things that we'll be trying to unpack a little bit throughout today's episode is, while I might have pain in my shin, what are some of the drivers for this pain? And then further to that, how can I help alleviate some of the pain that I'm feeling? So when we talk about shin splints in the medical world are referred to something as either medial or lateral tibial stress syndrome. And medial tibial stress syndrome is the one that's discussed a lot more often and more referred to as the common shin splint. So what are we really trying to get across when we talk about medial or lateral tibial stress syndrome? So the tibia is the largest bone in the lower leg, and it's on the medial side or the inside of the leg. And then you've got another small bone known as the fibula. And the fibula, again, being very small, only takes about 1/8 of your body weight. So the tibia takes the other 7/8 of the weight that's distributed through the lower limb as you run, walk, lift, push, press through the lower quarter. So it takes an awful lot of stress to begin with. And with a shin splint, the stress or the load that is imparted on the tissues surrounding the tibia is a little bit more than it can handle for a variety of reasons, which we'll discuss. And as a result of that, we get maybe some increase in pain, some local increases in inflammation. Maybe we get some irritation to the tissue in that area or the peripheral nerves in that area. And as a result, we might start to develop discomfort, disability, and start this injury cycle. So when we talk about medial or lateral tibial stress syndrome, as it's defined, it's really an irritation to the area of the tibia. And this might be, again, certain tissues in the area, bone in the area, or peripheral nerves in the area. Now, I mentioned bone in the area, and it's important to note that there can be involvement of bone in a medial or lateral tibial stress syndrome. So when we talk about bone, a bone like the tibia, for example, it's really made up of three distinct areas. We have an outer layer on the bone, and a lot of the long bones in the body have a similar architecture to them. We have a layer called the periosteum. And if you think about the periosteum as like a very thin saran wrap-like layer that surrounds the outside of all of our long bones. And then underneath the periosteum, we have compact bone. And compact bone is referred to as hard bone. And then if we go deeper into a bone, if you were to say saw a bone in half, you would see trabecular or spongy bone. And spongy bone is very porous, almost like just exactly that, a sponge, which is what's called spongy bone. And throughout our trabecular bone, we have kind of blood vessels throughout. And then typically in a long bone, we'll have a sort of central canal where we'll have additional blood supply and nerve supply, as well as our bone marrow. And that's how a lot of our long bones are set up, and the tibia is no different than that. Now, when we talk about medial and lateral tibial stress syndrome, one of the common areas that we are concerned with is that layer of the periosteum, and in particular, the space, and again, there isn't really any true space, but if we were to separate off those two layers, the space between the periosteum and the compact bone, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. So we have the architecture of the bone, and then we have soft tissue that runs along bone everywhere in the body, and the soft tissue might be fascial tissue, which is that sort of strapping, almost gray, gristly stuff you see in the remnants of steak or chicken at times. We also have tendons, and we also have muscles. And when we talk about tibial stress syndromes or tibial stress injuries, one of the areas of concern is where the soft tissue blends into the bone. And this is known as the enthesis. If you were to take an electron microscope and blow up the junction between bone and muscle or tendon, it's almost interwoven. It's almost sewn into the bone at an area known as this enthesis. And here we have these Sharpies fibers, or these basically strings, anatomical strings that help anchor tissue to bone. And when we talk about medial or lateral tibial stress syndrome, this is one of the primary areas that we're concerned with, where soft tissue kind of blends into the bone at this area known as the enthesis, and then what is happening there, and is it causing an increase in inflammation, increase in sensitization of the nerves in that area? Is it causing swelling? Where is that swelling located? And as a result of that, is that what is causing the symptoms that the patient is feeling? So now that we have a little bit of a kind of a background as to what might be going on locally, what are the typical causes of something like a medial tibial stress syndrome? We see this a lot in any sport that involves running. So running recreational athletes or competitive athletes, either in track or cross country, marathon, Ironman, half marathon. We see it in sports like soccer, lacrosse, field sports like football. And a lot of this has to do, or the thoughts around a lot of it has to do with volume and the ability of our tissues to recover. So what will happen as a result is the primary complaint is just that shin pain, either on the medial side, the inside of the shin, or the lateral side, the outside of the shin. And if you look at your own shin, you kind of have this long ridge. So either it's on the inside or the outside of that. And then the potential loss of function associated with that. And so this might be dull, achy pain, and we'll talk about some of the classic symptoms a little bit later, but ultimately it starts with some degree of discomfort along the shin somewhere. And so the first thing that I always want to take into consideration, which I'm sure if you've listened to my podcast in the past, you understand that if somebody comes in saying that they've got one thing, I always want to assume that they don't and go through this process of inclusion by exclusion. So I want to rule out all of the other things, particularly things that might be a little bit more sinister first, and then come to the conclusion that yes, they may have this specific injury, or they may just have something like a sore shin, and it may just be the tissue's overused and they don't necessarily have anything that needs further investigation, and we can manage this appropriately with some maybe soft tissue work and exercise or what have you. So what are things that generally cause shin pain that might not be a medial tibial stress syndrome, I think would be a great place to start. The first is low back pain. And we know that injuries to the low back can refer pain into the leg, and the front of the shin is no different than that. So on the lateral side of the leg, or the outside part, lateral to the tibia, the nerve roots of L4 and L5, so if you have an injury to those areas at L4 and L5, they can refer pain to that part of the shin. Now, how might I help determine whether my shin pain is coming from my low back? The first question usually I ask is, well, do you have a history of low back pain, or did you hurt your back recently, particularly in the last year? Do you have radicular symptoms, which are kind of linear, sharp, long shooting pain symptoms down the leg that might start in the hip and also go into the shin? Might you have other neurological signs and symptoms? So do you have consistent foot drop, which means your foot slaps on the ground when you're trying to lift it up, either in running or maybe you're trying to step over a curb and you find like you can't clear your foot, so you can't lift your toes up to clear the curb and the foot continually gets caught on the curb. If your foot drop is consistent, as in it's there all of the time, these are things that might make me think that your shin pain might in fact be related to your leg pain. Now on the inside of the shin, we can still have, again, low back symptoms. The L3 nerve root, a little bit higher up in the back, refers into the inner aspect of the shin as well. So if you have a history of back pain, particularly substantial back pain, and you have any of the other symptoms that I discussed, the long shooting pain or the symptoms of foot drop, and you haven't necessarily talked to your provider about the fact that your shin pain might be related to your back pain, it may be a conversation that you want to have. And it's not always going to be the case, but it's certainly you want to be ruling that out. Now, if we carry along the same conversation about nerves, well, nerves can get caught in tissue after they leave the back. And these are known as peripheral nerve entrapments. And particularly in the shin, there are two nerves that can get caught in tissue that can send signals back to the brain and the body and sometimes elicit a painful response. Now, this first nerve is known as the superficial fibular nerve, and this is a branch of your sciatic nerve, which many people know, that's coming down the back of the leg, and then at the knee it's splitting into two nerves, the deep and the superficial fibular nerve. And the superficial fibular nerve allows you to feel sensation on the front of your shin. So this can get caught in tissue and or around bone, and when it does so, it can affect some of the local health of the nerve and sometimes elicit or propagate pain along its track. As a result of that, you might feel shin pain on the outside of the shin. Now, there's also a nerve known as the saphenous nerve, which provides sensation to the leg on the inside of the shin, and the saphenous nerve is a branch of a nerve known as the femoral nerve that's coming down the front of the leg through the quadricep muscle, and it supplies sensation to the inside of the shin and kind of inside of the ankle bone, as well as the front part of the knee. And so in either circumstance, again, maybe it's being caught in tissue, maybe it's being caught around bone, it can affect the local health of the nerve, and this can create a bit of an inflammatory response around it. And as a result of that, it will propagate or send signals, referred signals or referred pain along the nerve's track into areas of skin that nerve is responsible for creating sensation on. And so we can see this in the outside or the inside of the shin, as I said. And these aren't always the first thing that many people think of when they have shin pain. They often think local, and sometimes that is in fact the case. However, I think it is important to consider low back injury and then peripheral nerve injury before moving to some of those more local structures. So we've talked about nerve injury. Now, what else is really, really common, especially in runners, that might be creating similar symptoms to shin splints? And one of those things that I see and have seen quite a bit in my practice, particularly in females, and I don't know if there's any research to support this, but this is just anecdotal for me, is something known as exertional compartment syndrome. So in the leg, especially the lower leg, we have these little compartments. We've got a front compartment, we've got an outside or lateral compartment, we've got two compartments in the back of the leg, known as the posterior superficial and deep compartments. And within those compartments, we have first muscle and tissue, and then we also have nerves, and we have blood supply. And in the anterior compartment, or the front compartment of the shin, we have the anterior tibial artery and vein, and we have a nerve known as the deep fibular nerve. Now, what can happen in these compartments is, as we go through exercise and the muscles are working, there is a demand locally to manage things like metabolic waste from exercise, so the waste products that we create, as well as manage the blood flow in and out. And sometimes the compartments will swell as we're unable to clear the metabolic waste products as well as the blood adequately. And this can happen for a number of reasons. This can happen because the entire Limb strength on that side might not be carrying the load. This can be from a previous injury. This can be because of loss of lower limb muscle mass. There are a number of reasons that can cause exertional compartment syndrome. But what happens is the blood starts to accumulate and it can't be cleared back up towards the heart fast enough. And that area will swell and it will start to compress the blood vessels further and it will compress the nerves in the area. And as a result of that, you'll start to feel kind of pain along the front of the shin. You'll feel some fullness in the front of the shin. And if you continue your activity, you might start to actually see the limb get visibly larger below the knee. So the calf and the front of the shin might swell. It might look a little bit blue. You might continue to feel that sensation of tightness. And then you might start to get that foot drop. That foot might get a little bit lazy in. And typically we see this most often in runners. That foot might start to get a little bit lazy in the gait cycle. So you feel like it's really, really painful to lift it, or it might start to slap against the ground. And the key thing about exertional compartment syndrome is when you stop the activity. So typically this is some sort of running activity. Usually within a few minutes, 5 to 10 minutes, the leg feels relatively normal again. And then if you were to continue your activity, the onset of your symptoms might happen a little bit more rapidly. Now, one of the key distinctions between, let's say, exertional compartment syndrome and trying to rule out whether something has come from your low back is that foot drop. So in something like an exertional compartment syndrome, the foot drop disappears after you take that rest time. So you're running along the trails, you start to get that feeling of fullness in the shin, you kind of get burning, the foot starts to get lazy, you feel like you can't lift your foot anymore, especially when running up hills. You stop running, you're walking now for 5 or 10 minutes, you feel normal, and then you resume your activity and the onset of your symptoms comes along a little bit more quickly. Whereas in a low back injury that's causing foot drop, the foot drop is a little bit more consistent, which means it's there for pretty much all the time. You notice it at times where you're not exercising, so just walking up the stairs, and when you're having to clear your foot, sometimes you're hitting your foot. And so trying to distinguish, when is your foot drop most prominent? Is it there all of the time, or is it during exercise? And further to that point, it's not uncommon to get exertional compartment syndrome in both legs, which means as you're running, you feel those symptoms bilateral or in both legs. And when you stop or slow down, you get almost immediate relief. Exertional compartment syndrome is a really tricky one because it's often very difficult to diagnose. And one of the primary ways that it gets diagnosed is through something known as a Doppler ultrasound, which looks at blood flow specifically. But the challenge with Doppler ultrasounds is that you have to get the exam done in an environment that recreates your symptoms. So, for example, if I know somebody's getting an exertional compartment syndrome due to running, but the Doppler ultrasound is done, they haven't run, they're lying on an exam table, they haven't done any exercise this morning. If it's exertional, many times it's not going to be caught on a Doppler ultrasound. So often what I'll tell people to do is try and recreate the environment the best they can closest to their exam appointment. So go and start running stairs or run outside, and within 5 or so minutes of your exam, go inside and try and get that ultrasound done. Now, there is a difference between a Doppler ultrasound and an MSK ultrasound. A Doppler ultrasound looks at blood flow, like I mentioned, and a lot of the time those are ultrasounds that look for things like an exertional compartment syndrome or a blood clot, versus MSK ultrasounds look at soft tissue and ligaments and tendons and all of that good stuff. So you do have to get as well the proper exam done to try and rule out an exertional compartment syndrome. So now let's say we've ruled those things out. We've ruled out a peripheral nerve being irritated. We've ruled out a low back injury. We've ruled out a exertional compartment syndrome. And we are now starting to think that the injury that is being suffered might be related to that junction of soft tissue and bone. And so really what we have to think about then is what can go on there. And earlier I talked about the outer layer of compact bone being the periosteum. And then just inside that, you've got compact bone and trabecular bone. And so now I want to focus in on the potential for space to be developed between the periosteum and the compact bone. And one of three things can happen here, really. You can have something called a stress reaction, you can have a stress fracture, or you can have a shin splint. And all of those present quite similarly, and it is quite difficult to often distinctively say you have one versus the other. So let's try and discuss each a little bit as individual as we can. So what is a stress reaction? A stress reaction typically precedes a stress fracture. So a stress reaction is the accumulation of swelling between the periosteum, that outer layer, and the compact bone. So for whatever reason, maybe I am running to lose weight and I've gone from no running at all to running every single day, and I haven't given my body enough rest time. And as a result of that, locally within the shin, swelling has started to accumulate between the periosteum and the compact bone. Now, what is a stress fracture? If a stress reaction does not get the relief that it needs, it will develop into a stress fracture. So a stress fracture is that swelling continues to be between the periosteum and the compact bone. And as that swelling continues to increase and I get no relief from my symptoms, I get a fracturing or a cracking in the periosteum, not in the compact bone. So when we talk about fractures, a fracture is to the compact bone and or to the spongy bone, depending upon the degree of fracture that I have. But a stress fracture is a fracturing of the periosteum, just that outer layer. So how might I try and determine a stress reaction or a stress fracture from shin splints? For me, a lot of it might have to do with discomfort. The pain is substantial in a stress reaction or a stress fracture, and this isn't always true, but typically pain that's above 7 out of 10. So I consider 7 out of 10 is painful, but we can tolerate it. A decrease in function of the limb, so a consistent limp that has started to develop, or an unwillingness to do the activity. I no longer want to run or play my sport because it's too painful. One of the other things is pain at rest or night pain particularly. So I'm waking up in the middle of the night, my shin is just aching and it's killing me, or even hours after I've done my workout, I'm getting this consistent ache. Now, some practitioners actually use a tuning fork. So they'll take a tuning fork and put it on the shin. And there's some thought with respect to the vibration that that tuning fork creates in the bone, and that might elicit a more painful response. There's a little bit of controversy about that, and I don't often use a tuning fork. If I suspect that this might be the case, I just refer back to the family doctor for the right kind of imaging to try and confirm or deny my suspicion. But these are some of the things that I take into account with respect to trying to rule out a stress reaction or a stress fracture. So what are some other things that I see or have seen commonly in these presentations? Persistent stress fractures, so the person might already have a history of stress fractures elsewhere in the body. I also want to consider bone density. Is this person already dealing with osteopenia or osteoporosis? Do they already have a working diagnosis? If they have a lower bone density, we know that they're at a higher risk of fracture and stress fracture. Are they a high-end athlete or an amateur athlete with a lot of volume? So are they doing a lot of running without very much rest or recovery? And one particular subset of the population that I pay particularly close attention to is the female elite level athlete that might have something known as the female triad, which is often talked about in elite level sports. And the female triad is the presence of a lower bone density already, so they have osteopenia or osteoporosis, amenorrhea, which means a loss of their menstrual cycle, and disordered eating. And the disordered eating word I don't necessarily love because it doesn't distinguish between eating disorder versus disordered eating. And the definition around disordered eating here is they're closely watching their diet in terms of performance, and they don't have a diagnosed eating disorder. So often in elite level athletes with the female triad, they have a relatively high muscle mass and lean fat mass or body mass. And as a result of that, that can affect their bone density as well as affect their hormone balance, which ultimately leads to the loss of menstrual cycle. In these subsets of the population, I have seen, especially in runners, and again, this is just anecdotal, that there might be an increased incidence of stress fractures. But again, I'm always going back to these other things like history. And if I see this in my clinic, then I might want to pay a little bit more close attention to it. Now, how are stress fractures and stress reactions managed? A stress reaction, in my opinion, should be managed the exact same as a stress fracture, because as I said earlier, if a stress reaction isn't managed appropriately, the next step is that that periosteum is going to fracture. There does need to be a rest period, and it does need to be looked at and co-managed by a physician. Typically, somebody's put in a walking boot for a lower limb stress fracture, either in the foot or the shin, for 6 to 8 weeks to allow that to heal appropriately. And then that's followed closely by some rehabilitation. The reason that this is so important is the recurrence of stress fractures can be quite high. So if it's not managed appropriately the first time, and this isn't along the lines of just shin pain, whether this is in the foot or the ankle, if it's not managed appropriately, it can reoccur. And this isn't something, especially if you're dealing with elite level athletes, that you want to be continually managing. They are quite difficult. They become very frustrating for the athlete. So it is important that you get the appropriate diagnosis if this is in fact what's going on. Now, confirmation for a stress reaction or stress fracture happens with a bone scan. It doesn't happen with an x-ray. It's not going to be seen on an x-ray. So bone scan or MRI will typically catch it. And if the person hasn't had this and they're dealing with persistent symptoms over a period of time and they sort of fit the bill, then a image might in fact be needed to find the appropriate diagnosis. So once we've ruled out all of these things, potential back injury, potential peripheral injury, compartment syndrome, stress fracture or reaction, I kind of come to the conclusion that maybe they in fact have shin splints. So the signs and symptoms of shin splints are typically point tenderness along the shin. You might have some radiating pain up or down, and this can be again on the inside or the outside of the shin. The pain is usually temporarily improved by activity. So if I do my run, I actually feel a little bit better coming out of my run. And then the pain will come about for maybe an hour or two after. So for the first 30 minutes post-activity, I feel good, and then it starts to creep up, that dull, achy pain. Now, one thing I should say is just because you have shin splints, it doesn't mean that that can't progress into a stress reaction or a stress fracture as well. So if I have a shin splint, I always want to be mindful of that. The big question that comes up is, so now with an appropriate index of suspicion or diagnosis, how can I treat it? And really, if you have a low-grade shin splint, you essentially have a sore shin. There's not really a, you know, often we like to use these specific words to try and come up with a specific diagnosis and ultimately a specific treatment plan. But the reality of it is that, you know, you've got a little bit of inflammation that's sensitizing that area and the shin is sore and there is no stress fracture or any of these other things that we've been talking about throughout the podcast. And as a result, we need to manage it. So the first thing is using a modality that helps relieve some of your symptoms. Medically, this might be in the form of medication if you're being followed by a physician. If you're seeing someone like myself, it might be something like soft tissue therapies, acupuncture, or any of these other treatments that you find useful. And I've said this on other podcasts, there isn't necessarily one treatment that's better than the other for a shin splint presentation or really any presentation of injury in the body. Secondly, you do want to know whether or not there is a biomechanical cause of your injury. And this is typically where I'll defer to someone, especially in the running community, that looks at things like mechanics of the foot, mechanics of the leg, mechanics of the gait in general, and trying to determine whether their injury that they are suffering from might be related to biomechanics. And certainly there are instances where this might be the case, and there are instances where it may not be the case. But it's important to try and get somebody that's well-versed in this and can help the athlete make changes to, or the amateur runner, changes to their gait. In certain circumstances, this might require something like an orthotic. It might require specific exercises. And then there are cases where there won't be a huge biomechanical fault, and it might have something to do with training volume. So looking at, you know, how often are you running? Are you recovering appropriately? What are you doing in terms of your overall health profile, in terms of your nutrition and your hydration? Are you already dealing with a low bone density diagnosis? So do you have osteopenia or porosis? Have you had things like calcium, your vitamin D levels checked, discussion around vitamin K2? Those are probably the three most common vitamins that are discussed in reference to bone density. Are you seeing someone to help have that managed? Are you on a medication for your bone density, something like a Fosamax? These are all questions that you want to be answered when dealing with this to ensure that stress fractures might not be in that person's future. Other things that come to mind are things like shoe choice, looking at, again, training elements. Are you doing a lot of hill running? Can we switch you to, say, flatland running for a little bit? Can we use an external device to make your shin feel better during training? One of the things that I found, again, anecdotally, to be really beneficial for people is something like a compression sock. So can you run in a compression sock and be pain-free and wear a compression sock for a couple of hours after running and get relief? Can you use something like a kinesiology tape in the area of discomfort during running or activity, and that eliminates your pain? The great thing about things like compression socks and tape is the cost of the intervention is very, very minimal. The biggest thing for any type of shin splint is getting out of the injury cycle. And this can often be the most difficult thing. A lot of the time, it takes three or four of the previous things that I've just mentioned to get that person out of the injury cycle. A lot of it has to do with training volume and what's going on. Typically, there's not really enough rest time. As a result of that, the tissue in the area or that region is becoming sensitized from either a neurological perspective or a soft tissue perspective, or the nervous system in general is just a little bit angry and it's telling you to do something about your training. And this, again, doesn't always reflect in elite level athletics. It might be simply an amateur athlete that's running too often. In my experience, if none of this changes, one of the things that can certainly occur is, again, your shin splint can develop into a stress fracture or a stress reaction. If you're somebody that's listening to this and you're leaning more towards, look, I've had this for a really long time. I've had this for 6 or 7 months. I continually struggle. I stop running for a week. I go back to it. It flares up substantially again. I'm becoming a little bit more disabled. I've got a limp. Some of the things, Connor, you've said to me during the podcast have made me think stress reaction or stress fracture. You're certainly going to want to go and visit a practitioner to get that appropriate diagnosis and get it managed appropriately so you can get out of that pain or injury cycle. But the great news about this is once you've figured out whatever is creating an environment that is perpetuating the injury or a number of these things, the resolution of these symptoms and this injury is very, very good. It's got a great prognosis long term. So while there might be some apprehension around the injury, and obviously these are quite painful, regardless of whether it's just a shin splint or a stress reaction or stress fracture, having shin pain is often quite uncomfortable. And especially if you are doing things in your life that you already love, and it's sort of affecting that in terms of running or walking or playing a sport you love. Once you find the couple of things that will help you along your way, many, many times you're able to return to your pre-injury status, which is always great news. So just a couple of things in review. Again, with shin pain, you always want to try and make sure that it's not coming from the back, coming from a peripheral nerve. You want to consider things like an exertional compartment syndrome. And then in dealing with local shin pain, you always want to try and make sure that you're not dealing with a stress reaction or stress fracture that's gone amiss. And then once you've kind of isolated it to your quote-unquote shin splints, what are the things that you can do to help you along the way? External devices like a compression sock or tape, seeing whether there's biomechanical faults or a need to change footwear. But ultimately, there is going to be something in your training that will need to change a little bit, either temporarily or permanently. That might be the terrain that you're on, the amount of times you're running, your rest time. And then ultimately, what's helping you recover? Is your nutrition sound? Is your hydration sound? Is there an underlying condition that you're aware of that you're also managing, something like an osteoporosis or osteopenia? And then once you get all those things underway, you have a tendency to move into the right direction. My question for you this week, folks, is have you suffered from shin splints in the past or a stress fracture, stress reaction? And what has helped you move away from that? I'd love to know in the comments below. As always, I hope that you found this episode to be of value to you. Have yourselves a great weekend, and we will see you in the next one.